Good evening. You're listening to It's the Economy on KGNU. I'm Antonia Yuhas, and I'm excited to be your host for today's show. Tonight, we're going to discuss oil, fossil fuels, and the global economy, and it's been a wild week for all three. We'll start off here in Colorado, looking at the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on our state and what it could or should be doing to the state's fossil fuel industry. Our guest is Micah Parkin, Executive Director of 350 Colorado. Next, we'll turn to the anniversary earlier this week, marking 10 years since a blowout deep in the Gulf of Mexico at BP's Macondo oil well led to a series of explosions aboard the Deepwater Horizon rig. It killed 11 men and resulted in the worst offshore drilling oil spill in history. Our guest, John Amos, is a former oil industry geologist turned oil spill specialist and president of SkyTruth, working to ensure transparency of an industry that has thrived in the dark. I'll then discuss with you the historic collapse of oil prices this week, what it means for you and I, Trump's plan for an oil industry bailout, and what should happen instead. All that in the next hour. We begin tonight with guest Micah Parkin. She's Executive Director of 350 Colorado. Thank you so much for being with us, Micah.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You bet. Let's just start, if you could please briefly introduce 350 Colorado to our listeners.
Sure. 350 Colorado, we're a nonprofit organization based here in this, around the state. We have different local teams across the state, and we're focused on addressing the climate crisis and transitioning to a sustainable future.
Okay, great. How many do you have members in the state?
Yes, we have around 20,000 members currently.
Great, thank you. Okay, so 350 really caught my attention earlier this month when, in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, 350 joined with other groups in the state calling for all fossil fuel extraction and production activities known to release harmful VOCs and air pollution to be ceased without exception throughout the state for at least 30 days and until the pandemic is contained in Colorado. So this was quite an ask. And I just wanted to start off with asking you to explain the reasons for this demand. What led to this petition?
Certainly. Well, as we know, many businesses have had to close their doors right now to protect public health and safety. And there have been several studies now, including a recent Harvard study that shows that increased pollution increases the vulnerability of our bodies and our lungs to COVID-19 and results in worse outcomes from the pandemic. And so we've started this this petition to Governor Polis and his administration, calling for his administration to halt all oil and gas activities, all fossil fuel activities during this pandemic, in order to protect people's lungs and to try to decrease really bad outcomes from COVID-19 during the pandemic. And we've had 27 groups so far who've signed on, and 2,000 Coloradans so far have signed on in support.
What are some of those other groups?
Oh, goodness. There are quite a few. There are groups Colorado Rising and Weld Air and Water and Together Against Neighborhood Drilling, Friends of the Earth, Mothers Out Front, some different faith organizations, Colorado Coalition for Livable Climate, and others.
Okay. So the Harvard study that you mentioned is really interesting. That's a study that was showing that basically COVID-19, one of the main areas that the virus attacks is our lungs. And can you talk a little bit more about what this connection was that the study made between pollution and COVID-19? And then also these new data that's come out right here in our area, in the Boulder County area, showing that while pollution from automobiles has decreased, pollution, and including this potentially same type of pollution that could worsen COVID-19, has actually increased from the oil and gas industry in our area.
Sure. Well, so The World Health Organization has warned against high pollution levels, pointing toward worse outcomes with COVID-19. And also the Harvard study showed that air pollution, high levels of air pollution, could raise the risk of dying from COVID-19. And so with those studies and others as well that we've heard of, showing this really strong correlation between high pollution levels and bad outcomes, including death from COVID-19, we thought that the only responsible thing is that the fossil fuel industry should halt, you know, pollution during the pandemic so that we're not exacerbating the crisis. And we know that, unfortunately, all along the Front Range, we have very, very bad air pollution. You know, the World Health Organization, sorry, not the World Health Organization, the American Lung Association has given most of the Front Range counties D's or F's in air quality. And this is because of ozone and other volatile organic compounds that make us much more likely to have poor asthma, you know, poor health conditions such as asthma, other respiratory conditions, even heart attacks and strokes and dementia are all associated with these higher air pollution levels. And the study that you pointed out, or, you know, the data that came out just recently was from a researcher named Dr. Detlef Helmig, who has been running air monitoring at three different locations along the Front Range. And his data was showing that although pollution levels from vehicles had decreased during the pandemic, it showed the underlying continuous air pollution that's coming from oil and gas, primarily from fracking. And so that these are precursors, air pollution that's precursors for ozone and also toxins such as benzene that can lead to cancer.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at this study and it showed that basically that most of us have seen our skies are cleaner because there's less car traffic, so less of the air pollutants that derive from automobile traffic, but that he actually found that benzene, ethane, and methane have continued to increase in the Front Range, and that those are gases that he's been able to link to the oil and gas production, as you say, primarily fracking in the state, and that means that essentially exposure to chemicals that make it harder for our lungs to fight back against the COVID-19 virus, were we to get it, are increasing in the air at this time. And to me, that study is pretty astounding, actually. And one of the things that we're seeing with the oil and gas industry is that in response to the Trump administration decided last month to ease reporting requirements on polluters, including the oil and gas industry, so that they are not required to report how much pollution they're releasing into the air. And what seems to be happening across the country is a spike in those pollutants as a result. And that seems to be what the data here in Colorado is showing as well. And then sort of getting back where we started, you know, 350.org and other organizations, or excuse me, 350 Colorado and other organizations saw that the response to that should be essentially shutting down these operations. What sort of response have you gotten from the state or from industry to this, or elected officials, to this demand to halt these operations during the time of the virus?
Unfortunately, so far, no response whatsoever. We delivered the petition once we had around 1,500 signatures and about 25 organizations had signed on. We delivered it to Governor Polis, to his administration, to the Colorado, the CDPHE, Colorado Public Health Department, and also the COGCC, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which permits additional new oil and gas permits. At the very least, we shouldn't be permitting new additional oil and gas permitting at this time. But we have had no response whatsoever. Also, the State Land Board, a lot of our public lands are being used and auctioned off for oil and gas drilling as well. And while we have record low oil prices, which, and, you know, adding to the glut on the market, which makes zero sense.
So you haven't gotten a response. What has been happening is that the state is in the midst of this historic rulemaking process to implement Senate Bill 181, the bill which reoriented the Oil and Gas Commission to a state commission whose key focus is production and expanding production of oil and natural gas, to one whose key mission statement is now protecting public health and the environment. And implementation of that bill has been underway. And one would certainly think that protecting us from COVID-19 would fall under that mandate and that requirement. Can you tell us where things stand with the rulemaking process and implementation of this bill?
Sure. And unfortunately, the news is not good. SB 181 passed over a year ago now. And sadly, very, very little has been done in the last year. Over 2,000 different new additional oil and gas permits have been permitted by the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the COGCC, and the rulemaking, very, very little has happened in this rulemaking that was supposed to be protecting public health and safety. And it was supposed to change the mission of the COGCC such that they were prioritizing public health and safety over these oil and gas producers. And unfortunately, like I say, very little of the rulemaking has even been rolled out. And sadly, at their last COGCC meeting, the COGCC announced that they wouldn't be delaying any permitting of new oil and gas fracking amidst the pandemic. And a couple of days later, we saw an announcement that they would be halting the or postponing the rulemaking that was supposed to protect public health and safety until at least this summer, midsummer. And so, you know, not only are they not going forward with the rulemaking that's supposed to protect us, they're continuing in the meantime to go with the same old rules and permit more oil and gas fracking that's making us more vulnerable to this pandemic, which just seems, you know, completely foolish.
Was there a discussion when the decision was made to continue permitting during COVID-19? Was this at a public hearing? Was there an opportunity to present concerns about COVID-19? And was there a response or any sort of statement about why new permitting would continue?
Yes, they had a public hearing, and for the first time, and we've been going, and many of our members across the state have been showing up at these hearings monthly, and this was the first of the hearings that have been moved online and because of the pandemic. And for the first time in a very long time, there was a huge turnout from the oil and gas industry calling on them to postpone the rulemaking, the SB 181 rulemaking. And we had, you know, dozens and dozens of different individuals who had signed up and were planning to speak and call for, and many of them, several of them had the opportunity, but quite a number of individuals didn't. They were cut off. They shut off the public hearing portion before many of the individuals got to speak and share their concerns about the pandemic and the continued permitting during the pandemic and the delay of SB 181 rulemaking. It was not good democracy in action, let's just say.
You know, what do you think is behind the push to keep, you know, moving forward? I think, it was clear that Governor Polis and the Democrats controlling the state house wanted to turn the tide on oil and gas production in the state with SB 181, which clearly wasn't a perfect bill, but is certainly, you know, I would say in my experience, the most progressive attempt to change regulation of how oil and gas is regulated in the United States in decades. You know, what do you think's happened between the promise of SB 181 and the reality of what's happening now with implementation?
You know, it's a bit of a mystery why it hasn't done what it was supposed to do. And, you know, for many folks, many folks believe that what's been happening is illegal, the continued permitting of new oil and gas without heeding this new law, you know, that we have now for over a year. But it only, to me, it speaks to the power of the fossil fuel industry and its impact on our government and on different lawmakers and appointed officials. And it's disturbing because, you know, the law now says that public health and safety has to be prioritized, and it's not being, unfortunately, is what we continue to see, even in this time of pandemic. So, you know, it's hard. It's very hard to know what we can do about that, except to keep calling on our leaders, on Governor Polis, especially, and his administration to protect us. And so we're encouraging people to send letters to them and write letters to the editor and let it be known that this is not acceptable.
You know, one of the things that's facing our state is that we have a deeply indebted industry. The fracking industry nationwide is in debt by the tune of about $200 billion. Mm-hmm. And our own state is in debt by the tune of, I think, $28 billion at the moment. So it also means that these are companies that are facing even greater threat now that the price of oil has bottomed out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, perhaps they're trying to pump as much as they can at a time when the price of each barrel that they pump is for oil that's being traded in Texas at the moment, it's now a negative price for the first time in history.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, what does this bankrupting in the state mean for our state, for the state of these companies, and what is 350 looking at in response?
Well, it's very concerning because of the low oil prices. Their experts are predicting that as many as 500 oil and gas companies will go bankrupt in 2020, 2021, if the prices stay as low as $20 a barrel. And as you just pointed out, they've recently gone far lower than that. And so we're looking at a huge number of these oil and gas companies going bankrupt. And we have over 80,000 wells across the state now. And these wells are extremely expensive to clean up and cap and shut in when they finish production. And 90% of that production is over in the first 3 years. And so our organization and many of our partner organizations are extremely concerned that our communities and our state are going to be left having to clean up the mess and recap all of those wells. And it can cost, those shut-ins and cleanups can cost as much as $250,000 to even, we've seen examples of $1 million per well. And again, we have 80,000 wells in Colorado. And these fracking companies, they're now being called zombie companies because they've survived their entire existence on borrowing to service their debt, and they can't even pay it down and cover their operations. And the entire industry, the fracking industry in the United States, has never even had 1 year of positive cash flow in aggregate in the U.S. And so, of course, these negative and very, very low oil prices are going to bankrupt many of these companies. And so our concern, you know, the bonding has been extremely ridiculously low. The severance tax has been very low in Colorado, and that we have, you know, no protective nest egg for our communities and our state to be able to clean up these messes once these companies have long gone from our state.
One of the reasons why the oil and gas industry is looking for a bailout from the Trump administration right now is that they are hoping that the federal government is going to buy this debt from the banks, bailing out both the banks and the oil industry. And that's one of the things that the industry has asked the Trump administration for this week. And I know that today has been a day of active campaigning across the country under the title Stop the Money Pipeline and looking at divestment from the oil and gas industry. Can you talk about what that organizing looks like and what 350 is doing with that?
Certainly. So this week is the 50th year anniversary of Earth Day. And since people can't take to the streets, groups around the world have been hosting a 3-day Earth Day live event online that has been focused on Wednesday on strikes, led by the Youth Climate Strikes. And Today on Thursday, the focus has been on divestment and the role that can play in addressing the climate crisis and human rights abuses that are happening. And also, and then Friday is focused on voting, getting out the vote for climate champions. And so today's Divest or Stop the Money Pipeline Day is focused on the large role that the big banks, the investment firms, and insurance companies are playing in financing climate disaster and human rights abuses by continuing to fund failing fossil fuel companies and projects. So each day at 9 and 5, Earth Day Live has gone local. And today in Colorado, the sessions covered at 9 a.m., we focused on how fossil fuel projects are impacting local communities of color and frontline communities. And this evening at 5, we covered divestment campaigns happening in Colorado to shift public funding out of fossil fuels. And anybody who's interested can watch or listen to these events by visiting our websites, 350colorado.org, or our Facebook page, 350colorado.
What are you asking, you know, listeners to do? How can they get involved in the divestment work? And just to, you know, sort of to add to that, the idea is that these oil companies, including in Colorado, that are so indebted, are essentially they're not making money on the oil that they're producing, and instead they're being supported by debt and by loans from the banking sector, so that if the banking sector stopped supporting them through loans and purchasing of their debt, they wouldn't be able to operate anymore, and shining that light on the banks behind the companies. So is there something that, yeah, you're asking listeners that they would be able to do in response to this divest call?
Sure. There are lots of things that we can do as individuals and ways that we can take action also together. So as individuals, we're just pointing out how people can take action in their own lives, of course, with their own investments and making sure that their own investments are not in fossil fuels and they're investing in local solutions, that they're banking with banks that are not contributing significantly to the climate crisis and human rights abuses. For example, JP Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo are heavily invested in fossil fuel companies and projects, and that are very controversial, and not only because they're leading to climate disaster and continuing to burn these fossil fuels, but also the human rights abuses and issues that are associated with many of the projects, like the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines that are on indigenous lands, that there are many issues around missing and murdered indigenous women who were near many of these projects, living near, and how they're going missing and often found murdered. And then here in Colorado, of course, with these big banks are funding fracking and other projects like that too, that are harmful to us and our local communities. So we're inviting people to take action by putting their money into solutions and making sure that they're not banking with the big banks, the big Wall Street banks that are contributing to these types of projects. And people can often bank with local credit unions or community banks. You should always check and just make sure they're not investing in fossil fuels, but those are usually safe bets. And then, of course, we can take action as individuals in what we buy and how we live and trying to fossil-free our own lives, too. And then there are many different campaigns that are happening right now in Colorado that people can get involved with, and they can take very simple actions, or they can get more deeply involved and go and speak and testify. For example, 1 in 10 Coloradans has their pension in PARA, the Public Employees Retirement Association, and many teachers and city employees, for example, university employees. And right now, PARA is still invested in fossil fuels. And we had a study done this past fall that showed that if PARA had divested 10 years ago, they would have saved billions in earnings, basically, if their investments had been fossil free. So people can go online to our website again, 350colorado.org, and sign on to a letter encouraging PARA to divest from fossil fuels. And We also are working on giving more options to our local governments and our state governments so that they are not having to bank with the big Wall Street banks. There's legislation that has been proposed that would enable cities to bank with local credit unions or to even create public banks. And public banking right now would be extremely helpful in that it would keep our dollars local, supporting local needs and local values, as opposed to going to Wall Street banks that are then investing that money, as we talked about before, in controversial fossil fuel projects. So that is legislation that you can go online. We're part of the Colorado Public Banking Coalition, mm-hmm. and people can go online and support that by going to coloradopublicbankingcoalition.org. There's a support letter that people can sign on to there. And we also, another campaign that people can get involved with is encouraging their local community governments to work with insurers who are not insuring or investing in fossil fuel companies or projects. So those are just a handful of the ongoing projects that we're working on right now that there are ways that people can get involved and help promote those in their own communities.
Well, thank you so much for that list. That's a lot for listeners to look at. And that website again is 350colorado.org. And you are listening to It's the Economy on KGNU. I'm Antonia Juhas, and my guest today has been Micah Parkin, Executive Director of 350 Colorado. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Take care. We turn now to the 10-year anniversary of the worst offshore drilling oil spill in history. On April 20th, 2010, a blowout at BP's Macondo oil well led to an explosion that destroyed the Deepwater Horizon. It killed 11 men and caused a three-month-long 200 million-gallon oil disaster that has continued to impact communities, economies, wildlife, and wild places across the Gulf ever since. Earlier this week, Louisiana's Gulf South Center for Law and Policy brought communities from across the region together virtually to commemorate the disaster. They called for an end to oil drilling and for a Green New Deal. One of the speakers was Daniel Lee, Executive Director of Boat People SOS, a Mississippi-based group working on behalf of the Vietnamese fishing community there.
This community in the Gulf Coast, in Biloxi area, has been there since in the late 1970s. Shortly after the Vietnam War. And they came here because of a similar climate to where they were living in Vietnam, which is the coastal town where fishing is the primary, job. When you come to America, you need to quickly make it a living to support a family. Fishing was the easiest one. You don't have to learn. You don't have to speak English to fish. So these people flocked to this area because of that very reason. And fishing is a passed down generation from generation, passed from the father to the son and to the son's son. So that has been a tradition for the Vietnamese community. But since the BP oil spill, that has been changed. Many have found that it's no longer, like I mentioned earlier, it's no longer viable anymore. So a lot of people have rather left the industry. I think 30% of our fishing community has left after the BP oil spill because, they couldn't make a living. It's no longer profitable or viable for people to continue with these professions.
One reason why fisher folk have not yet recovered is because neither has the ocean. Oil from the BP spill remains in the ocean ecosystem and on the ocean floor, and many species central to the area's seafood economy, including oysters, have yet to recover. But it's not just BP's oil that's of concern. Our next guest, John Amos, is a former oil industry geologist who used satellite images to explore for oil and gas for companies including Shell, Exxon, and BP. After seeing the environmental devastation these and other operations caused, he left the industry to form SkyTruth, a conservation technology nonprofit that uses satellite images and data to measure, among other things, oil spills in the ocean. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, your work at SkyTruth, and I came to learn about your work when I was covering BP Deepwater Horizon, and I think as the listeners probably know, I covered the spill for many outlets, including Rolling Stone and Harper's Magazine, and wrote a book called Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. But I was definitely learning by doing, as were a lot of reporters, and trying to understand what a oil spill of this magnitude meant for the Gulf of Mexico, and really trying to understand offshore drilling and the risks associated with it, because we were also constantly running up against a sort of smoke screen by the industry and even by government regulators trying to tell us that everything was much better than it turned out to be. And the work of SkyTruth was just fundamental in removing that smoke screen and revealing the truth about this, the size of this disaster. But I want to, before we get to BP, I actually want to go back to the work that you did after Hurricane Katrina. And I want to start there, because what the world is facing right now is this massive glut of oil that's building up everywhere. And we're also getting ready for hurricane season to come, where there is oil that's being sort of clogged and stored in tankers, in tanks. And we're often told by the industry, you know, not to worry, that their operations are safe and sound, and not to worry about hurricanes coming and hitting the Gulf Coast. And we can talk a little bit more about what's happened through hurricanes in the Gulf Coast to storage tanks. But let's talk first about what's happened to offshore drilling operations as a result of hurricanes and the work that you all did following Katrina.
Sure. So that was in 2005, and SkyTruth was still a fairly young organization at that point. And we had the awful tragedy of Katrina hitting the Gulf and swamping New Orleans, and creating just some astonishing death and destruction in U.S. territory that we didn't think was possible. And like everyone, we were just deeply concerned with the scope of the human tragedy that was unfolding along the Gulf Coast and in New Orleans in particular. But we were also mindful of the, you know, based on my experience working for industry, I'd actually done some exploration studies in the Gulf of Mexico. And I'd used satellite imagery as a tool to identify the natural oil slicks that occur in the Gulf. But I also knew about the just the intensity and the level of oil industry hardware that's out in the Gulf. Mm. That really is an eye opener for most people when they find out about this. The thousands of platforms and fixed structures in the Gulf, tens of thousands of miles of pipeline on the seafloor in the Gulf. And I realized, looking at the maps, that, you know, Hurricane Katrina had gone like a Category 5 buzzsaw right through the heart of that infrastructure. So we started looking at satellite imagery to see if we could detect any signs of problems out in the Gulf, 50, 100 miles offshore, as a result of that catastrophic storm passing through. And at the time, we were hearing assurances from industry and from government officials in several different government agencies, as well as politicians of every political stripe, that everything was fine with the oil and gas industry out in the Gulf, that all the platforms had been safely and orderly shut in a safe and orderly manner. Everyone had been safely evacuated. There were no injuries or loss of life. And I heard this again and again, quote, "not a drop of oil has been spilled," unquote. And so when we got our first radar satellite image of the Gulf, that was, I think, was collected on September 3rd, just a couple days after landfall, I was astonished to see a very large area of the Gulf of Mexico covered by oil slicks. And in looking at the imagery and analyzing it in detail, it was clear that at least as of September 3rd, there were continuing ongoing leaks coming from dozens of platforms and likely from broken pipelines on the seafloor. So it was not just a drop of oil. It was hundreds of square miles covered by oil slick. So that was alarming to us, and particularly alarming because industry, who should know what had happened to their hardware, and government officials, who should be closely regulating and watching that industry, were saying something that was exactly the opposite of what the satellite imagery was demonstrating.
And you've actually found that it was 9 million gallons of oil that was spilled during Hurricane Katrina, or released.
And, you know, I think it was about 9 months later, the Department of Homeland Security, of which the U.S. Coast Guard was part, actually issued a report to Congress where collecting industry, mostly from industry self-reporting, they estimated that 9 million gallons of oil had been spilled. And we calculated that about 750,000 of that was from offshore facilities. Those leaks were almost certainly underreported. And the bulk of the oil that was spilled as a result of hurricane damage was actually from damaged coastal facilities. And you mentioned those storage tanks. And they really proved to be the Achilles heel along the Gulf Coast when it comes to exposure to severe storms. I think there was one oil storage tank operated by, I think it was Murphy Oil, that was lifted off its base by stormwaters. And then when the stormwaters receded and it settled back down, it didn't come down gently. And it spilled more than 1 million gallons of crude oil into the floodwaters, swamping the community of Chalmette, Louisiana, that had not only been hit by severe flooding, but had crude oil infiltrating people's houses and neighborhoods on top of that problem. So this was another revelation that, you know, you can't have offshore oil development without the buildup of all of this coastal infrastructure to handle the oil and gas that's coming from those offshore wells. And these storage facilities proved to be ticking time bombs when it comes to severe storms making landfall.
And that definitely has not gone away. With Hurricane Maria, that was also a problem with storage tanks rupturing the same way, releasing toxins into the communities around them. So it has not been solved, and was certainly, now you're saying, something that the industry has known since at least 2005, if not sooner. And one of the things that you have reported is that this, you know, we hear about large disasters, but that chronic oil pollution and underreporting is a problem that pervades offshore drilling. Can you talk a little bit more about that, you know, sort of this consistent dual problem of pollution and underreporting?
Sure. And they unfortunately seem to go locked hand in hand. And we've seen over the years persistent and disturbing pattern that government tends to go along with what the industry is saying about the levels of pollution, the severity, the persistence and pervasiveness. And that makes it even more difficult for the public to actually know what's happening out on public waters offshore. You know, this is our property, it's our resource. And yet the people that we count on to take care of it show a pattern of being less than accurate, less than forthcoming about the problems that are occurring out there. So the BP spill itself, well, so the Katrina spill was one glaring example of that. And 5 years later, when the BP spill was unfolding, there were still prominent officials repeating the long disproven line that not a drop of oil had spilled during Hurricane Katrina. I was astonished by that. I was actually invited on a talk show, and the pro-industry person who was sitting on the show repeated that line, not a drop of oil was spilled. And I just couldn't believe that people were continuing to get away with what had been disproven by a government agency years earlier. During the BP spill, once again, we saw BP saying that the spill was 1,000 barrels of oil a day. And let me point out, that is a horrifying spill in terms of size. Mm-hmm. That's 42,000 gallons of oil gushing into the sea every single day. So when BP said our well is spilling 1,000 barrels of oil a day, that was a credibly bad number. And the Coast Guard went along with that for days to weeks. And yet our analysis based on satellite imagery within the first week showed that the real number had to be at least 20 or even 27 times greater than that. An appalling spill. So with these catastrophic incidents, we see this pattern, but it also extends, as you mentioned, to the kind of the run of the mill day-to-day pollution that is created by offshore oil and gas development. And this is something that really flies under the radar of the public consciousness. People don't talk about it very much, but it's a critically important thing to understand. If your beach community is being asked to accept the expansion of offshore drilling into your area, where perhaps your economy is built around the public perception that your water is clean and your beaches are pristine. So this chronic oil pollution is something that we started studying shortly after the BP spill, when we accidentally discovered on our satellite imagery a chronic leak that was creating an oil slick visible day in and day out that was totally unrelated to the BP spill. And this we later learned was at the site of an oil platform that had been operated by a company called Taylor Energy Company. And when the Coast Guard realized they had to say something publicly about this leak, they said that it had started when the platform had gotten knocked over by a mudslide on the seafloor that had been triggered by Hurricane Ivan. When we heard that, we scratched our heads because Hurricane Ivan was not a name that we, you know, was in our memory. And then we realized that's because Hurricane Ivan had actually happened 6 years earlier in the fall of 2004. And we were astonished that our government had allowed a chronic leak to continue for 6 years, leaking oil into the Gulf 24/7, 365. So that was the first sign that we really needed to start looking at these smaller incidents that weren't making the news to see what we could understand about that. And what we learned is that the public information that's available on the accidental leaks and spills that happen all the time out in the Gulf, the public information is incomplete, difficult to access and use. And when we could compare the public information to our own direct measurements and estimates of leaks and spills that we could see on satellite imagery, along with Florida State University, we concluded that typically industry was underreporting those spills by an order of magnitude. So we came to the conclusion that, you know, it's virtually impossible for the public to know how bad the chronic day-to-day pollution is that accompanies offshore oil and gas drilling.
Well, and a report that I'm reading that you put out shows 18,000 oil spills reported to the Coast Guard just since the BP Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico, so since 2010, and that you had estimated that on average, what the companies are reporting is underestimating the size of spills by a factor of 10, which is incredible. And just so listeners know, the studies that you did on the size of the BP Deepwater Horizon spill forced both BP and the federal government to revise up the spill amount, the size of the spill that they were reporting, to get to the place that, you know, that we now believe to be accurate, that ultimately the 200 million gallon spill, but that was because of the work that you and Dr. Ian McDonald were doing. But now, what do you think has changed, if anything, in terms of the industry or the government being in a position to prevent another BP Deepwater Horizon size disaster, today? What lessons, if any, have been implemented since Deepwater Horizon?
That's a great question. I think what we've been hearing from, you know, a variety of experts over the past 2 or 3 weeks is that a lot of the lessons that were presented, I should say, by the BP Deepwater Horizon catastrophe, a lot of those lessons have not been learned and are not being acted upon effectively. On the regulatory front, we still have the same regulatory framework that puts the polluter in charge of the pollution response, and really makes the government kind of a backseat driver at best of the cleanup process. And so one consequence of that during the BP spill scientists who had the equipment and the techniques to be able to accurately measure how fast oil was gushing out of the broken Macondo well on the seafloor, they were actually barred from the site. Mm-hmm. And BP had control of the site. So I assume that was their decision and the U.S. government went along with that. And then what ensued over the next few weeks, you may remember there was a series of different engineering solutions that were tried to stop that gusher of oil on the seafloor a mile below the ocean surface. And every one of them failed. Everyone was under-engineered to really solve the problem. And it makes you wonder if scientists, outside scientists, have been allowed in that first week to precisely measure just how bad oil was gushing out of that well, you know, would we have saved some time in going right to the final engineering solution that finally succeeded, and cut this short and spared the Gulf from the 2 to 2.4 million gallons of oil a day that flowed into the water while we were dinking around trying to figure out how to stop it?
Well, and what, you know, I've learned is that basically there were some regulations to deal with the blowout that happened at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico that the Obama administration put into place, and that there was, when companies knew that these new rules were going to be implemented, they did start shaping up their activities, and blowouts went down to zero, but that the Trump administration then lifted those regulations that were put in place by the Obama administration. And now, regulatorily speaking, everything is back the way it was before the disaster happened. And Congress hasn't done anything in response to the BP oil spill. No laws have been changed by Congress. So that, you know, the potential for another disaster is probably even higher, given that the companies are drilling out even much deeper now than they were when they were doing Deepwater Horizon in riskier parts of the Gulf of Mexico. But things have also gotten riskier. You have highlighted the impacts, potential impacts in the Gulf of Mexico of the regulatory changes that the Trump administration has put in place since COVID-19. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this this gets back to the public's ability to look over the shoulder of government and industry to see what's actually happening out there in the Gulf. And on March 26th, the EPA announced that they were going to temporarily suspend the rules that required industry to monitor their operations for leaks and spills and to report those leaks and spills promptly to the government. And so in the Gulf of Mexico, we looked at the average daily number of oil spills and gas leaks that were reported from January 1st of this year up to March 26th, when EPA announced they were relaxing this reporting rule. And then we looked at the average daily number of spills reported after the rule was suspended, and we saw about a 40% drop in the number of oil spills and gas leaks that were being reported in the Gulf of Mexico. And we're pretty confident that's not because those leaks and spills stopped happening.
I just want to sort of sum up by making sure that listeners understand this, which is that, you know, potentially up to 40% of the amount of oil that's being released into the Gulf of Mexico as pollution is not getting reported, which means that the public doesn't know that these spills are happening and therefore cannot trace them back to the source and therefore cannot repair any sort of you know, larger problem that this is symptomatic of. And I actually have a great example of this, which is that there was an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico from Exxon's Hoover pipeline. Shell reported that they had to shut in their Perdido offshore oil operations because of the pipeline spill, but Exxon had not reported the spill. So the only reason why we were able to sort of backtrack and find out that there had been a rupture to this oil pipeline is because Shell made an announcement about its platform. A reporter then dug into the story and then got Exxon to talk. So this is, you know, very potentially very problematic. But it brings us to the state of the Gulf where we are now, which is, you know, as you've written before, that we have an industry that is choosing to obfuscate the truth most often, and that the amount of oil that's chronically released into the Gulf of Mexico, you know, is even worse when added together than the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. And just thank you for all of your work that you've done to reveal this information. How can listeners learn more and find out more about Sky Truth?
Well, you know, they can always check us out on our website at skytruth.org. And if they want to follow us on our blog, they can sign up to get a little email notification whenever we publish something new to our blog. They can also, of course, follow us on social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. So I would encourage readers to check us out. And if they're interested, ask us questions.
Great. Thank you. You're listening to It's the Economy on KGNU. I'm Antonia Yuhas, and my guest today has been John Amos, president of Sky Truth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Antonia.
In our final 5 minutes, I want to turn to the historic collapse in oil prices that happened this week. For the first time in history, oil was trading at well below $0 a barrel. In Texas, oil was trading at negative nearly $40 a barrel. That means that producers were paying buyers to take oil off of their hands. In Oklahoma, they deemed oil production, quote, economic waste. What's going on? The first thing is that the global oil industry was in extreme crisis well before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. The main problem, extreme overproduction. There was already an oil glut. They're producing a product that the world is trying very hard to get off of and can get off of. The industry describes it as the looming peak oil demand, the point at which demand for oil is forever going to be falling. In the U.S., the fracking industry was so overproducing that the fracking industry alone was $200 billion in debt before the COVID-19 crisis hit. Enter the pandemic. Demand for oil has, of course, collapsed. We can all look out our windows and see the effect. We can see the clear skies. Cars aren't driving. Trucks aren't driving. A great deal of industry isn't taking place. And the effect is clear skies and collapsed demand. That collapsed demand met continued production, producing oil countries continued to produce, oil companies continued to produce, and then we had a glut that just turned into a flood of oil. So much oil that we're running out of places to put it. Tanks are full, tankers are full. There's nowhere to put all of the product that's being produced. Then this week, energy futures traders went from the virtual world where they trade in futures contracts into the physical world, where certain traders had to turn their contracts into exchange for a physical product. But these were contracts for something that nobody wants and there's nowhere to put it. That sent the price of oil just crashing to historic lows. This is an extreme problem at the domestic level and the international level. The global economy is hardwired to oil. If it collapses, that could mean that the global recession that is already underway because of the COVID-19 crisis would be much, much worse. We're facing 2008 in reverse. In 2008, the price of oil went up to $150 a barrel. Consumer countries couldn't afford it, and that set off the global financial economic collapse. Now we're in the opposite direction. The price of oil has collapsed, and producer countries and producers can't make money off of their product. We don't want to allow this type of financial collapse. There are solutions, but the first solution is not the oil industry bailout that the Trump administration has proposed or that Trump tweeted about earlier this week. What the industry wants to happen in that bailout is, remember that $200 billion that I mentioned earlier, that debt the industry had already incurred before the COVID-19 crisis. What the industry wants is for the federal government to use our tax dollars, yours and mine, to buy that debt. So we would be subsidizing the banks that had been supporting the fossil fuel industry and the oil industry that had been overproducing a product that people weren't buying with our tax dollars. It would also most likely come in the form of grants. That's a bad idea. A good idea is to implement the rapid managed decline of oil production. Those places and states and nations that can start keeping their oil in the ground need to choose to do so. We can also implement the rapid transition to a green economy through the Green New Deal by financially supporting the federal government, financially supporting workers so that they can rapidly transition into green sector jobs, and financially supporting those oil companies that want to take a payout to get paid out to shut down. and to use federal money for that. We can also make sure that we identify this as a global problem. We need to direct international money in the same way. So first of all, the International Monetary Fund needs to expand its program that it's already begun in forgiving debt to poor countries. But also we can use the Paris Climate Agreement. It already has a financial mechanism where rich countries pay poor countries to help them adapt to climate change. We need to expand that money for rich countries to pay poor countries to keep their oil in the ground and to instead use money to rapidly invest in a green energy-based economy. We have the means to do this. We have the tools in our grasp. Now we just need to put them into place. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you have a great day.